We've been trying to do is to say, is there a need to, and can we make Genesis 1 to 3 fit current scientific thinking? That's what we've been trying to do, essentially. And we've been looking at different Christian interpretations of how you deal with Genesis 1 to 3. Young Earth creationism, omphalos theory, gap creation, and so on, all the way down. You'll notice that I've got a little black arrow between those two, because I think it's entirely possible to believe both in theistic evolution and literary theory. To believe that essentially Genesis 1 and 2 are poetry. They are myth, but in the best sense of the word, myth in the sense that they contain very deep truths. You can believe in theistic evolution, that the mechanism for creation was evolution, and link it to literary theory. You'll notice I've also said only those views highlighted in yellow, in the reading I've done, have significant support from evangelical Christians. So I'm just quickly homing in on those four: young earth creationism, day age, theistic evolution, and literary theory. And they all have their supporters. And it's interesting how the support varies and develops as well. So in summary, young earth creationism, particularly found in America, but it's also here as well, believes in a young earth. The earth is between 6 and 10,000 years old, and it believes that evolution is just plain wrong, and it does its own science. There is actually a museum in America of young earth creationism and discovery creationism. So that's young earth creationism. We had a good look at that, arguments for and against. Day age creationism, which I think is the kind of thing that people tend to believe if they haven't done much study in this area. They'll say to you, oh, each day was an age. All the 7 days were thousands or millions of years each. So they would accept an old earth. They'd accept that the earth might be about 4 billion years old. But they would see evolution as being wrong. So that's day age creationism. And then evolutionary creationism, yes, we accept that the earth is old and evolution is right. It's the mechanism whereby God created and developed all life. And these are all positions held by evangelical Christians. And that's quite important. And then literary theory accepts an old earth. And accepts, not always, accepts that evolution is correct and is a correct current theory. As we saw last week, Henri Blocher, who wrote a very interesting book on this called In the Beginning, he is quite prepared to be open-minded about both, but he does see Genesis 1 particularly as literary, not as literally true, but as a poem or something similar. So we've looked at those four, and maybe you've had time to kind of think through where you stand on those. But I did want to stress that they're all held by evangelical Christians. They all, in one way or another, would be held by evangelical Christians, thoughtful evangelical Christians. And I thought it would be good just to recap on what we said about evangelical Christians, because we use this word evangelical without realizing, boy, it covers a very wide area. It really does, a huge area. So I just very simply said, well, what do evangelical Christians believe? They'd all accept that the Bible is the authoritative word of God. They would all accept that it's been inspired by the Holy Spirit. They may differ on what we mean by inspired. They would argue that it's trustworthy for what we should believe, the faith we should have, and the way we should live and behave. They would argue that it's a source for guidance in life as well. So they all have a very high view of the Bible. And I'd also say other Christians, non-evangelical Christians, also give a high authority to the Bible, but it will depend, it will vary. You may remember, those of you who came to the series Paul did on homosexuality, he ran through six different possible views of the Bible. And to my interest, he said, they vary from very conservative, the Bible is absolutely literally true, word for word, no errors, no faults, through to a much more liberal position. And he said, I would be about three. That's where our Paul was. He was about three, which puts him firmly in the thoughtful evangelical camp. And most evangelicals would argue it has a plain meaning. I would want to dissent from that. I would say, actually, the Bible is an extraordinarily complex book that has to be wrestled with. And that was one of the mantras of Ruth, those of you who might remember our previous pastor. She said, you have to wrestle with the Bible to get hold of its meaning and to understand it. The debate within evangelicalism is between those who might be called, although I don't like the word, literalists, and those who are much more non-literal, because it seems to me clear that in the Bible there are things that clearly are not long literal, they're not meant to be taken literally, and there are other things that might well be needing to be taken literally. But there is a debate there, and I think the debate, again, this is a little bit misleading, is between those who believe that the Bible has no errors in it whatsoever, none at all, and those who say, yeah, there may be errors, but it's still infallible for faith and practice. It's utterly reliable for how we should live and for what we should believe. And I just wanted to stress that point that evangelicals disagree, and they disagree about or emphasize differently many issues. Homosexuality is currently the really big one that is engulfing the churches in very heated debate. And that isn't a problem. That really isn't a problem. If you were to tour the churches in Southampton, you would find a very different take among different evangelical churches in various ways. So I don't think that's something to be frightened of. The truth is, Christians have a very varied view of how you understand and deal with and live by the Bible. And then we go to Orthodoxy, Greek and Russian. And then we go to Roman Catholicism. Christianity is an incredibly broad set of beliefs. And I know some people would say, well, Catholics aren't Christians. Some Catholics would say Protestants aren't Christians. We kind of moved on a bit in the debate from that kind of polarization. Okay. So I want to challenge you right from the start. You recognize that. I think almost anyone could say it by heart. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That comes from the NIV translation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We know, as far as the evidence shows us, that the earth or the universe did have a beginning. That's what the evidence currently suggests, and it's quite strong evidence. Compare it with that. Different, isn't it? Really very different. Now, John Walton wrote, he's actually written a trilogy, three books on Genesis 1 to 3. I've only read the first one, The Lost World of Genesis 1, published by IVP. Now that gives you a clue about where his Christianity is. IVP is an evangelical publishing house, particularly in America. So he's an evangelical. He's a member of the Society of Evangelical Scholars. He's an Old Testament scholar, and he's an expert on the ancient Near East, on its culture, its languages, its understanding, and that includes, of course, Israel. So he's an evangelical scholar, and he blew my mind. This book was suggested to me, I started reading it, and I thought, oh, this doesn't fit any of the interpretations, not one of them. And I was really very shocked and then extremely excited. Now, I'm not going to say whether I think it's right or wrong. That's for you to decide. But let's start with the way he sees, in what is quite a short book, the Genesis story, Genesis 1 in particular. So I start off with a quote from his book, page 60. Adoption of the framework of the target audience is most logical. Why don't we start by saying, what was the worldview of the people who wrote Genesis 1 and 2 and 3? And what was the worldview of the people who received it? That's really important, isn't it? Are we imposing our cultural understanding in the 21st century on what is, although it's part of the Bible, ancient literature written by people with an ancient Near Eastern worldview and received by people with an ancient Near Eastern worldview? And one of the things that really excited me about this book was I was beginning to think, well, yeah, but does that make it reliable? And he then said, why shouldn't God accommodate himself to who we are and where we're at and where our culture is and what our time and place is? Why shouldn't God speak to us through who we are and where we're at the time? That's what God does. God speaks to us differently from the way he spoke to people in the 17th, 18th, 19th, even 20th century. Why not? Maybe God is infinitely resourceful, and that might tell us something about God. So he starts there, and I think that's a very interesting place to begin. He then picks up on two absolutely key Hebrew words. And remember, he's something of an expert in Hebrew. And he tries to work through how they're used in the Bible, particularly in Genesis 1. Now, bara means to create. It means to create. In the beginning, to create. Esa means to make or to do. And so he looks at them and he says, do you know what? They're not about creation from the beginning. They're not about creation from nothing. They're nothing to do with starting something off at all. Genesis 1 isn't talking about in the beginning God made everything. Genesis 1 is saying in the beginning God had all this material that he'd made some time before, maybe thousands or millions of years before, and it was shapeless and void and formless, and it had no purpose, no function. Can someone help me here? What does the word functional mean? What does the word functional mean?
Of use.
Sorry?
Of use.
Of use, thank you. That's two words, incredibly quick, helpful, really useful definition. My laptop was non-functional this morning. It wasn't doing what I wanted it to do. So I called over Nick, who's our expert in everything technical, and he said, yeah, you see that? You actually have to plug it in. Okay? So it became functional. It started working. It had meaning and purpose. It had what philosophers call telos. Goal, it was going somewhere, it was worth something, because without that in, it was useless, it wasn't doing anything at all. So he says, actually, yes, he's quite happy to accept that God did originally create from nothing, but what he's doing in Genesis is taking what is formless and void and shapeless, darkness was over the face of the deep, and he's beginning to assign functions to it. He's beginning to give it purpose. So let's go further and see what he says. In Genesis 1, God was assigning functions to systems and plants and animals. These are his key principles. God was creating order from chaos. Now, if you've ever had a child who had a bedroom, and we had a daughter who is now the most wonderful person in the world and the mother of three children and lives the most amazing life. As a teenager, if I went into her bedroom, it was formless and void. It was creating from chaos. And when Judy would go in there to clean the room, she would just take a look and close the door and come out, okay? Now, you may have had that kind of teenager. She's now really quite tidy, isn't it interesting? So God was creating order from chaos. Now, here's an interesting reference to that. Now, the earth was formless and void, says Genesis 1 verse 2. And here's the real take home. Genesis 1 to 3 and science aren't in conflict at all, because they're doing different things. They're doing completely different things. There's no need for this level of conflict. And there's no need for young men and women who become Christians and go to university and find major challenges to their faith because they do science or whatever, and they meet the kind of issues we're dealing with. There's no need for them to lose their faith. And there's no need for them to give up science to try and remain Christians. They're doing different things. That's what Walton argues, and I'll illustrate that further later on. Let's see if we can actually illustrate this further. You may have seen diagrams of this. So I'm going to call it A&E from now on. Ancient Near Eastern Cosmology, view of the world, understanding of the world. Commonly envisaged a flat, disc-shaped earth surrounded by water and a solid dome-like firmament, almost like, you know, those games you can have where you have a little plastic round thing with a glass or plastic dome on the top and you shake it up, you know, that kind of feeling. This model typically included three domains: heaven, earth and the sea, and then a netherworld below it. Now, I've relied heavily on AI for that definition, so you see how incredibly modern I am. Okay, so look at Genesis 1 verses 6 to 7. Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water. You might feel, well, that kind of fits this ancient Near Eastern view. And there's my rather sad attempt to illustrate what the ancient Near Eastern view of the world was. So there's, if you like, there's the flat earth on pillars. There's Sheol, the underworld, the world of the dead with waters below it. There's the sun and the moon. There's your firmament with its stars. There are waters above it. You have to have a firmament to stop the waters coming through. But can you see I've got some lines here? I've got one there and the other side, because that's where the rain comes through. Okay, that's where the rain comes through. So that was the ancient Near Eastern kind of view of the world. And it was one shared by the people of Israel, as well as the people around it. And that might partly explain why the accounts in Genesis, particularly in Genesis 1, are similar to many ancient Near Eastern accounts of the origins of the earth and of life and of God, the gods and so on. There are real differences, but there are real similarities. So that's the worldview that those folk were actually living with. So Walton argues, we must not impose our own cultural thinking on the text. We have to stand back and we have to try and think our way into the mindset of the people who wrote Genesis and the people who received it. Now, for me, that's clearly a very demanding thing to do, which is why people like Walton spend their working lives doing it. But originally I was trained as a historian, so it's nothing new to me. My whole training was, how do I think myself back into the mind of Richard I, or Queen Victoria, or President Lincoln? How do I understand how they saw the world? And how do historians interpret that? And the Bible is ancient literature. It's very important that we get to grips with that. Yes, it's God's word, but it's also ancient literature. And we need to get into the mindset and we need to step back from our own culture. And I thought this was interesting. There's no distinction, Walton argues, in the ancient Near East between natural and supernatural. There's no distinction. The gods pervaded everything. Everything was the plaything of the gods, including men and women. The gods pervaded everything. And I think that's fascinating, because if we're Christians today, we shouldn't want to make a distinction between the natural and the supernatural. I believe God is in both. I believe God is working through both, and I'll try and illustrate that later on. I want a situation in which I can be a methodological atheist if I do science, but doing it from a Christian worldview. And by that I mean, I've never done it, but if I did science, not saying, where does God come here? Where is God in this? There's a wonderful cartoon that shows a board full of maths, okay? And the man is working through the maths. He's obviously a brilliant mathematician. And he gets to one gap. And he says, that's where a miracle happens, okay? Now, that's not the way Christians should do science. It's really not, because it's a God of the gaps approach. And the trouble with gaps is, as science moves on and discovers more things, the gap for God gets narrower and narrower and narrower. So we shouldn't go down that route. I want to believe that I want to be a Christian in terms of my worldview and looking at science. And if I were a scientist, I'd want to be a methodological atheist. I ask, what caused that? And I look for causes in the world. But I believe that God made all of that. And one scientist said, science is thinking God's thoughts after him. Isn't that an interesting perspective on science? Okay. Ancient Near East people thought that something existed, and this is really the key point, because it had a function. They weren't interested in how it began. They were interested in what was it for? What was its function? I have no interest whatsoever in how my laptop came to be. I'm not a techie in any way, shape or form, but I am interested in what it does for me. And that's really important. So for ancient Near East people, Walton argues, they wanted to know what it was for, not how did it come to being. So it's about function, not about creation. This is really very different, isn't it? And then in verse 2, the Hebrew word tohu, which is translated formless and void, according to Walton, means unproductive, purposeless, lacking function. Lacking function. So he takes the Hebrew, which he's an expert, and he actually tries to show how it would fit his interpretation. And when we see that very famous, and God saw that it was good, what that means is it was functioning properly, particularly with regard to humans. It was doing its job as it should be doing. It was working properly. Now, Nick was telling me before we started that you go into the main sanctuary and every week the settings on all the tech have changed. And every week there's another problem to solve. So it's not functioning properly. But I'm not suggesting that Nick is God when he goes round to put it all right. Okay, so we move on. Verses 3 to 5 are best translated as, let there be a period of light as against a period of dark. So time is being created. Yeah, we know when the day is, when the night is. He's creating time because God, according to many philosophers, is outside of time, but he works in time. And that's very important. So that's verses 3 to 5. And when he translates the word firmament, translated as sky, it's functional. He actually creates rain. And we cannot live without rain. And some of us are beginning to get slightly nervous about when rain is coming. So he's actually making rain, which will make life possible. He's creating a functional system. And then comes dry land and crops and fruit and the ability for human beings to come into existence. The ability for human life to start. Now, I'm a bit cautious about the way we tend to dismiss animals and us, the way we tend to separate those two out, because that gives us almost a sense of we can do what we like with animals. Doesn't matter. I believe animals have incredible value in God's eyes. But I also believe when God created humans, he gave us an ability that so far as we can tell, animals don't have. And that's an ability to relate to him and to ask big questions. When did you last see your dog say, "Why am I here?" Other than, "Is it food time?" "Why am I alive? Where am I going? What's the point of my existence?" Only we ask those questions. And they're incredibly profound and important questions. And they raise huge issues for us. And in days 4 to 6, God creates by installing the functionaries, the things that will have function and purpose. He creates lights, stars, animals, us. And that's really very important. But he's doing it all with pre-existing material that had been formless and shapeless and void. So this is his interpretation. And humans have a function to rule and to relate to God. We are in God's image, and that word image has very profound meanings when you start thinking about it. Thank goodness it doesn't mean we physically look like God, particularly as we get older. It means perhaps that we can relate to a spiritual being. It means that we can ask questions deeper and bigger than ourselves. It means that we have consciences and we make moral choices. When did you last see an animal make a moral choice? Well, some do, in the sense that some are incredibly protective of their young. But essentially, if you look at most animals, they're not making moral choices as such. So there's Adam and Eve. Next week we'll ask whether they really existed, but that's for another week. Genesis 2 verse 7 mirrors ancient Near Eastern texts about humans being created from materials. They refer to humanity as a whole. And isn't it interesting that the text says, "The Lord formed the man from the dust of the ground." The dust of the ground. And the Hebrew word for this is for Adam, Adamah, means ground. It means ground. So we are dust. I'm sorry to tell you guys, we are dust. And in fact, interestingly, I don't know if you heard a lady being interviewed this week. They've got some stardust, and in their research on it, they think it's older than the sun. So many billions of years old, older than the sun. And she said, of course, we're just animated stardust. And in a way, she's right. But isn't it amazing that we're somehow more than that? If you are an atheist materialist, like Richard Dawkins, I'm very sorry for you. Because essentially, life starts, it has no deeper meaning or purpose, and then you die. But worse than that, you think you make free choices, you don't. Because you're completely at the command of your electrical activity in your brain and your chemicals that are shaping and guiding you. You are nothing but materials. And that's a pretty bleak atheist philosophy, I think. And that's why you get that wonderful advert from Richard Dawkins that they put on buses years ago. Do you remember any of it? There probably isn't a God, so get on with enjoying the rest of your life. What a depressing advert on a bus. And some very cheeky Christians replied with a very similar poster. There probably isn't a Richard Dawkins, so. And the reason they did that was that he was invited to come and debate in Oxford with William Lane Craig. Now, nobody in their right mind debates with William Lane Craig. If you don't believe me, go and listen to him. He's all over YouTube. He's terrifyingly brilliant. And he spent his entire life defending the Christian faith. And they asked Dawkins to come and debate with him, and Dawkins said, "I'm busy. I'm busy." He wouldn't come, hence the advert. So yes, we're stardust. Yes, we're animated dust. But we're more. Walton believes that Adam and Eve were a historical couple. Isn't that interesting? So although Genesis 1 and 2 are very different from what we've understood, he does believe Adam and Eve existed, but he didn't think they were the first human beings. He didn't believe they were the only human beings, or even the universal ancestors of all human beings. So he sees them as emerging, coming at a point in time. He claims the Bible makes no claims about biological human origins. At a point in time, Walton argues, God gave his image to Adam and Eve, and then all human beings forward from them. That's when the capacity to relate to God happened. So in this sense, he's kind of on the more liberal evangelical end, but also on quite a conservative evangelical end as well. So that's the way he deals with Genesis 1 in particular. On day 7, God rests. God completes his work and comes into his temple. The cosmos is his temple. The earth is part of his temple. That's where God is. Now that creates some quite difficult theological ideas for those who believe that God is both outside of the universe, but kind of in it as well, a mixture of the two. But this idea that God actually is in the cosmos, it's his temple. It's where God dwells and relates to us. I think is a really interesting one, and it might shape the way we deal with our world. If you saw this world as God's temple, might you and I be a bit more careful about how we live in it, what we do with it, and how we control our environment and deal with environmental problems? Very interesting issue there. And then God rested. And this will possibly blow your mind and really challenge you. God's rest entailed engaging in normal activities once stability had been reached. In other words, the managing director had arrived in the building and had sat in his office and was now making sure that everything functioned perfectly. Is that Sabbath? That's interesting. There's a really different view of Sabbath, isn't it? In all sorts of ways. And I found that very challenging as well. So the idea of God as the managing director who's making sure everything works. And I remember saying to some of my students some years ago, imagine a globe. There's a globe here and it's resting on your hands. And if you were God, you could do that. And the globe could just die and disappear. But God sustains it every second of every minute of every day and ensures its continuing existence and functioning in ways that allow us to be alive. And that's a very deep and important Christian doctrine. But think about how we live Sabbath. If Sabbath is engaging in normal activities once stability is reached, that requires a little bit of thinking through, doesn't it? There's all sorts of issues going on there, and I'm going to duck all of them because I really don't know what we should do with that. So the temple for the Jewish people wasn't primarily a place of worship. It was the dwelling place of God. And in Genesis, the temple is the whole cosmos. So if you imagine God actually literally seeing, knowing, understanding, shaping, sustaining, maintaining everything with a loving heart to make life possible and to enjoy life and all the life that he sees. That tells you something about God. And what I loved about his interpretation, he says, humans are stewards. We're in relationship with God. We're privileged. But in other ancient Near Eastern texts, humans were slaves. They were slaves of the gods. The gods could do what they liked with them. But not with our God, not with the God of the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, we could relate to God. We were given stewardship of the earth. And I suspect you agree with me that we're not doing a very good job of stewarding the earth. Okay. Look at that. In modern materialism, the only function of human beings, essentially, is to survive and to pass on your genes to someone else. And have anyone read Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene? Very interesting book. He basically says we are essentially gene machines. The genes control us and the genes tell us we must reproduce. And we must reproduce to the next generation. And that's what we are. I think we are that, but I think we're an awful lot more than that. And that's an incredibly bleak understanding of what it is to be human. And the selfish gene is selfish because it wants to reproduce whatever the cost. It's been pointed out that's a really odd word term for a book. How can a gene be selfish? Very interesting question. And here's his kind of take home. Viewing Genesis as an account of functional origins of the cosmos doesn't in any way suggest that God was uninvolved in material origins. It just contends that Genesis is not that story. So he does believe that God created the world from nothing. But he doesn't believe that's what Genesis is telling us. He believes that what Genesis is telling us is that God took what he created and he gave it shape and function and form and purpose and meaning. And for me, that's incredibly exciting and gives me lots of understanding of my God. Okay, so what about science? There's no conflict once we understand properly the relationship. There is no conflict between religion and science. And again and again and again, I listen to people like Stephen Meyer, John Lennox, John Polkinghorne, brilliant scientists who were Christians. They don't see a conflict. They don't see any problems. They think this whole thing is just completely unnecessary. The Old Testament world didn't distinguish between natural and supernatural. God was in it all. And I love the way John Walton illustrated this. You can have a piece afterwards if you like. So you start with the top layer of your cake, and the top layer is ultimate causes. What's the ultimate cause of our universe? Where's it going? What's its teleology? What's its purpose? What's its meaning? What is the universe all about? Is it going somewhere? Is it under intelligent direction and control? And the bottom layer is science. And science gives us lots of explanation, and it's enormously important. And we love what science does for us. Those of us who are now increasingly getting elderly, and our pill count at morning breakfast is growing, you know. I'm really grateful to live now, not 100 years ago, not 200 years ago. I'm grateful that if I have an emergency dental problem, I can nip down to Noel's Dentistry and get it dealt with quickly and painlessly, even better. So actually, God is in all of that. God is in every part. We can use science to understand our world and our universe, but we can always hold to that worldview that God gives it, ultimate cause, ultimate teleology, ultimate meaning, ultimate purpose. In my first session, I talked about a guy called Keith Ward, and he's an absolutely brilliant defender of the Christian faith. And in what's perhaps his best book, God, Chance and Necessity, he goes to great lengths to show that evolution cannot work unless there's a guiding mind behind it. Now that's a really interesting idea, isn't it? In other words, evolution isn't purposeless. It isn't blind chance. It isn't meaningless. So we as Christians can see God in all of it, but we can do our science as Christians with a Christian worldview, but scientists who look for cause and effect and why things happen and an explanation. And is he right? Is he right? Is John Walton right? Is this the breakthrough Christians have needed for hundreds of years? And you're going to hope now that I'm going to tell you whether he's right or wrong. And I'm not. Okay. What I'm going to do is say a lot of it comes down to how you understand those two key words. Do they mean creating from nothing? Does bara, to create, mean I'm creating from nothing? Same would be true of Asa. Or does it mean I'm working on existing materials to shape and form them? And there is a very lively debate going on about how we should interpret those Hebrew words. And critics of Walton, it won't surprise you that young earth creationists are pretty critical of him, but a lot of other people are sympathetically critical, say no. When you see the word bara in the Old Testament, it nearly always means creating from nothing. Now Walton disagrees with that. So it leads to some very, very detailed analysis of biblical texts to support or criticise Walton and decide whether you agree with him or not. And it's really about, does the text in Genesis 1 describe material or functional origins? Does it describe creation from nothing, or does it describe shaping existing material? And it's probably a debate that only really biblical specialists can get into, but if you're grabbed by this and want to know more, I suggest that you Google critique of John Walton's book, The Lost World of Genesis 1, and there's a particularly good one you could land on called Paradigms on Pilgrimage, where they do respectfully disagree with Walton, but they do it in a really nice, unnasty, scholarly way. But there are lots of other sites there as well. So you could, if you wish, follow up your own research on that. So what do you think? And with this, I'm beginning to come to an end. I've now completed our look at a range of different explanations of Genesis 1 and 2. So I'm just going to pose these questions. I don't want you to put your hands up. I want you to think about where you are with each of these questions. Do you think God created the world in, let's say, 6 or 7 24-hour periods? Or do you think it was done over a much longer time period? Do you think we have a young Earth, 6 to 10,000 years old, or a very, very old Earth, possibly 4 billion years old? Do you believe in a real Adam? And we haven't looked at this yet. Or do you think he's a kind of prototype, he's a kind of representation of all of humanity? And next week, I'm saying it with fear and trembling, that's where we're going. Because whether you believe in a real Adam or not has very, very big theological interpretations. And next week, Paul is probably going to be here and he's going to be sitting in the audience, and he made me feel so relaxed when he said to me on Friday, well, of course, I did my dissertation on this. Okay, so I'm expecting some interesting thoughts. Is there a conflict between science and religion? Again, you can draw your own thoughts about that. Do you agree with Walton? Do you think he's right? He's certainly come up with some really interesting ideas, and he's a respected Old Testament biblical scholar. Do you believe in the Big Bang? Do you believe in evolution theory? Do you think it's right? Do you think it's true? So these are the kind of things you can think about. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of my first part of what we're going to do, but I just want to leave you with this thought. If you are comfortable with any of those views, or you don't even think they matter, it doesn't affect your faith. Brilliant. But please remember, there are people out there for whom it matters very much, and for whom it's having powerful impacts on whether they come to faith or not, and how they cope with the challenges from science to our Christian faith, and with the challenges from biblical studies to our Christian faith as well. So it's important that we think these things through and have good answers. And I end with a story by a man called David Cook, who was a Christian thinker and scholar at Oxford University. And I remember him giving a lecture in which he said, "I once went to give a talk in front of a lot of very academic, brilliant people on Christian faith, and they tore me to shreds. And I went away saying, I will never let that happen again." And what was his answer? "I will study more, I will think more, I will tease this all out, I will follow it through." And aren't we lucky that we have people like Paul and Astrid who do quite a lot of that work for us. Thank you very much. Any questions from anyone? Anyone want to make a comment of any kind? We have a minute or two. Okay, you're all shattered.
Didn't explain the word
teleology? I did, but I'll do it again anyway, no problem. Teleology is the idea of end goal or purpose. So if something has teleology, it has a goal, it's going somewhere, it has a purpose. So that's its meaning, but thank you for reminding me, no problem. Anyone else? Okay, thank you very much, everybody.